So, continuing with our philosophical camp, should all come out being philosophers. That means we should all understand. Tomara Charan, what is it? Tomara Charan? What's the name? I never lost it. Bina Kichudon, Shongsare Na Kichua. Well, you're probably supposed to already know that before you come, but should know it even more firmly, more strongly. And be able to, well, it's not in one philosophical camp that there may be complete change, but that's the difference between Madhyam and Uttam, Bhakta. Madhya Bhakta is, well, the Jara Komal Shraddha, Shekhanishta Jan, then the Madhyamadhikari is, he has Dhirabhishas, firm faith, but maybe not able to resolve all the Siddhantas, but an Uttam Bhakta. He not only has firm faith, but can resolve all the apparent discrepancies in Shastra. These lights are not needed or wanted, so let's turn them off. Yeah. So, all right. Agyanatimirandhasya gyananjana shalakaya chakshura nilitam yena tasmai shri gurave namaha. Vandeham shri guru shri yatah parakamalam shri gurun vaishnavamscha shri rupam sagrajatam sahagana raghunatam vitam tam sajivam sadvaitam savadhutam Parijana Sahitam Krishna Taitanya Devam Sri Radha Krishna Padam Sahagana Lalita Shivishakanditamscha. Now I'm going to take up a philosophical issue that is a contentious issue, or discuss about contentious issues that are always there. It's always there in the material world. Namely, those rascal dog, kick him in the face, Mayavadis. But particularly, by the way, that wasn't something I made up. Srila Prabhupada, he said that in discussing with Dr. Patel, his philosophical discussions with Dr. Patel on the beach in Juhu. Dr. Patel was saying that, well, he should be somewhat tolerant. The Prabhupada said, why tolerant? If he's a Mayavadi, he's just a dog. I'd kick him in the face. So it wasn't just something I made up. It's taken from Srila Prabhupada. So that's always there in the material world, because there are always people wanting to avoid Krishna in various ways, and the most sophisticated way is to be a Mayavadi, in which you profess to believe in God and at the same time you don't. And also I'm going to bring in discussion of a modern manifestation of Mayavad called New Age, which is it's a Western manifestation of the centuries old hallowed by tradition doggishness of Mayavad, which is in India. Srila Prabhupada composed his own pranam mantra, in which he stated nirvishesha shunyavadi paschatadesha tarne. He's as a servant of Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, he is preaching Gauravani, the words, the message of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu in the Western countries, delivering the Western countries from impersonalism and voidism. When Srila Prabhupada was conducting classes in the science of the Absolute Truth, Bhagavat Tattva Vijnana, in a converted storefront in Second Avenue in Manhattan, in New York City, he had a few people coming, some of them later became his disciples, some regular visitors, who, hearing Srila Prabhupada often speaking about Mayavadis and impersonalists, thought that Swamiji was on some kind of trip about some kind of... There must be some sect in India that he doesn't like, and he keeps on talking about them. He seems to have some kind of a trip about that. Later they came to discover that they themselves were the impersonalists that Prabhupada was talking about. There was one particular incident where Srila Prabhupada was using the Dr. Radhakrishnan's translation of Bhagavad Gita, because he found the verse translations good enough to work with. At that time his first commentary on Bhagavad Gita had been stolen, and he was yet to recompose Bhagavad Gita as it is, as we have it now. So he's using Dr. Radhakrishnan's commentary. He was using his translations, but not his commentary. But he would often remark that Dr. Radhakrishnan and others of his ilk are deluded. Srila Prabhupada had already written a whole series of articles in Bengali, refuting, a series of articles, refuting Dr. Radhakrishnan's contention, which he gives in his commentary on the ninth chapter, 34th verse of Srimad Bhagavad Gita, Manmana Bhavamad Bhakto Madhyaji Mang Namaskaru. What's the next line? No, it's not Vayamaya Vaishyasi Satyam Te. What is it? Yeah. You always get lost there. Mame Vaishyasi Yugdvayavam Atmanam Matparayanaha. Anyways, more or less the same as the more often quoted verse, which has the same first two lines at the end of Bhagavad Gita. So anyway, in his commentary on this verse, Dr. Radhakrishnan says that it is not unto Krishna the person that one has to surrender, or one has to constantly think, but to the unborn within Krishna. And so Srila Prabhupada, 1965 or 6, commenting on this to Wally, Keith, Howard, and others, who are later to become Umapati, Kirtanananda, Hayagriva, said that he pointed, see what a rascal he is. Krishna clearly says, think of me. But this rascal says, he diverts and says, not to Krishna, but to the unborn within Krishna. But there is no unborn within Krishna. So at this point, Keith, who was the guru of sorts of the Mott Street crowd, who would read all different kinds of books and take LSD and smoke marijuana and have various realizations which they would share among themselves, he stood up in defense and launched a long spiel quoting from Shankara and St. John of the Cross and all kinds of modern and ancient impersonalists, both Western and Eastern. He was quite learned. Then Keith, after going on for some time defending Dr. Radhakrishnan, paused, and Swamiji said, "Have you finished?" Which prompted Keith to give another long defense, quoting more and more about the one soul within and the unity of all that be, etc., etc., etc. And then again, after some time, Swamiji asked, "Have you finished?" And in the meantime, Swamiji was sitting, getting just, his face was becoming red. And this time Keith said, "Yes, I finished." And then Swamiji smashed the dice and said, "It's Krishna. Krishna says, think of me. There's no unborn within Krishna. Why do you refuse Krishna?" So he became extremely angry. Now, these few people were the only something resembling followers that he had after months in America. At least they were coming regularly, but they weren't committed to Swamiji. But they thought, no, pretty good. We can mix it up with in our kichari of Shankara and St. John of the Cross and so many other. Mix it up with our... What's going on there? What happened? Anything happened, or is it just happening by spontaneous combustion, or what? Why is it that this sound has changed? The loose connection. So Prabhupada, he could have lost whatever little following he had. At least they were helping him in some way. But he couldn't tolerate to hear that Mayavad. And at that time, Howard and others realized that they themselves were the Mayavadis and the impersonalists that Srila Prabhupada was speaking against. They were part of a big international a big international conspiracy against Krishna. They were the Mayavadis who Prabhupada was preaching so strongly against. Not only them, they themselves were the ashray of that wrong understanding. So Srila Prabhupada was always very strongly against this. In India also, he was invited to a Gita Sammelan in Vardha, and some of the big swamis in India were present there. And behind the scenes, not on the stage, but Prabhupada with a whole group of them were there, and they were congratulating, "You've done such good work spreading Gita all over the world." And Prabhupada shouted at them all, that, "Why are you cheating people in the name of Bhagavad Gita?" He didn't just make friends with them, but he shouted at them, "Why, you have a Gita Sammelan here, why don't you teach what Krishna teaches?" So Srila Prabhupada, he was the mordant enemy of Mayavad because he loved Krishna. If we love Krishna, we can't simply sit while Krishna is being blasphemed, as do the Mayavadis. So Srila Prabhupada, he wasn't the first Swami to go to America, and particularly at that time and after Srila Prabhupada, there were many Swamis who went from India to America, before Srila Prabhupada had gone, Swami Vivekananda had been there. And although all Bengali Hindus think that Swami Vivekananda is highly famous all over America, and everyone in America, the first thing they do in the morning, after they've wiped their backside without taking bath, after passing stool, if they pass stool in the morning, they offer puja to Swami Vivekananda. Fortunately, not many people have heard of him in the modern day. At that time, he produced a sensation of sorts, a novelty, a Hindu Swami in America. It was a novelty more than it wasn't that the people were religiously affected. And he came back he traveled around a little bit, and he came back to India with one Irish woman. And so he went, and then after him another Bengali Swami went, Yogananda, whose autobiography of a yogi is famous among stupid people, even today, so-called seekers. I never had the privilege of reading it. Lucky for me. And so many Swamis went, all Mayavadis. So that the impression in the West is that you'll find in a dictionary, in any English dictionary, you will find a definition of Hinduism. And the dictionary, remember, it's supposed to be definitive. And they all say that Hinduism is a religion in which there are many gods, but they believe that the ultimate is an ineffable oneness. It's presumed that this is Hindu, that all Hindus subscribe to this, despite the fact that, apart from all the Mayavadis, there are Vaishnavas who are supposed to be opposed to this idea and accept Krishna or Vishnu as the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and not accepting the idea that there are many gods. So this idea has become very strong in the Western world, that Hinduism is polytheistic, and even though they worship various gods, they believe that ultimately everything is all one. And this idea became, or misconception, became more prominent, more embedded with the popularity of yoga and so many swamis going to the West and all teaching this in various ways, reinforcing this misconception. Of course, this disease of impersonalism was not started by Shankaracharya, but he gave a philosophical system to it, not actually philosophy, but pseudo-philosophy, and popularized it. And in the Western world also, there are various persons who have had various mystical realizations. Various mystics and saints in the Western world, Sufis. So it is widely spread that the absolute, ultimate reality is ineffable, inexpressible, beyond words, etc., 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 and with no form, beyond the realm of thought, etc., etc., etc. So we're all well acquainted with this despicable nonsense, which Srila Prabhupada opposed, and which he also gave as a duty to his discipular followers to oppose that. And it's not just a duty. It's not that, well, Prabhupada told us to, he wanted us to oppose it. But if one is actually developing any feeling for Krishna, then he must hate the enemies of Krishna, among which the Mayavad is the most prominent. Now, in the Western... I'll go back to India. Shankaracharya, he propagated Mayavad, and that was particularly one... If one is to be a true follower of Shankara, then he had to be a sannyasi, which means he had to be from Brahmin family. So, to become eligible for becoming one. In fact, just by taking sannyas, according to the Shankara Sampradaya, you become God. That's actually their philosophy. Dandagrahena matrena naro narayana bhavet. Just by accepting a sannyas danda, you become, a man becomes Narayana. It's in Sanskrit, in verse form, sounds authoritative, but it's nonsense. It is not a fact, but that's what they believe. In the Shankara Sampradaya, those who are pseudo-Narayanas, the sannyasis, and others who are not on that level, but who nevertheless they subscribe in spirit to the Shankara line, the smartas, they follow the rules of the Varnashram system, the Asura Varnashram, they follow many rules. So we could say that in some way Shankara made some, that's also accepted, that he made some contribution, that he restored the Vedic path, which was to a large extent obscured by Buddhism at that time in India. So the traditional Mayavadis, as we find, for instance, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu at Banaras, they were very austere. They studied the Vedanta, and they performed meditation. This Prakashananda Saraswati told Chaitanya Mahaprabhu that study of Vedanta and meditation, these are the duties of a sannyasi. So what are you jumping around the streets with all these low-class people for? He challenged Chaitanya Mahaprabhu thus. Now, Mayavad has gone to the West. And there is what is now called the New Age movement, which is, it's not a movement as such. You can't look up on the internet the world headquarters of the New Age movement. We won't find that exactly. But it's a, not organized in any way. In fact, that's one of the principles. Do your own thing. But there are various yoga groups, various teachers, and various individuals who are considered to be part of the New Age movement, which is strongly influenced by Mayavadi teachers who came to the West, who themselves, they're not Mayavadis in the strict traditional sense. that they follow so many different rules and regulations. In fact, if they were strict Mayavadis, they wouldn't have come to the West in the first place, because according to the rules of Shastra, one should not cross. If one crosses the ocean, he loses his status as a member of Vedic society. Then it's against the rules of Shastra to cross the ocean. One becomes fallen simply by doing so. So they went to the West and preached their various things. Now, if in the West they're to teach anything a little more than simply being a vegetarian, as far as rules and regulations are concerned, they're not likely to get many followers. So they've given a very diluted form. Nothing like the rules and regulations that the traditional Mayavadis have to follow. So it's really a loose bunch of people with various vague ideas of being or becoming one with everything. But at the same time, there are some apparently good things about that. Many of them are vegetarians. They have some kind of interest or respect for the Vedic knowledge. Many of them have Indian names. It's not only the Hare Krishna devotees in the West who have Indian names. There are others also, due to their affiliation with yoga groups or whatever. So maybe 20 years ago, so I heard, there was a disagreement about this between two of the Swamis in our Hare Krishna movement. Is New Age beneficial or not? Because on one hand they're Mayavadis, on the other hand they're taking some interest in Indian culture, they're vegetarians, and they believe in peace and all this kind of thing. So I had heard that two of our Swamis had a disagreement on this. Harikesh Swami, who thought that New Age was something overall quite good, that people are more willing to accept the underlying principles of Krishna consciousness, whereas Suhotra Swami thought he was something very bad. Now both of those Swamis have passed on to different realms, one in a glorious way and one in a inglorious or vainglorious way. But that is the question we can examine now. Is this New Age good? Another of our Swamis, who also passed away, Bhakti Tirtha Swami, often used the language of the New Age, especially this term consciousness raising. See, it's something good because they're consciousness raising. That's a common term among New Age. Another point that New Age is not just some few people here and there, yogis, people wearing yogi pants in the park doing exercises in the morning, but it has influenced mainstream society. These terms might be difficult for you to envisage, those of you from India, because it's different cultural setup in the West. Setup? Well, it's not really setup, it's just evolve like that. But there are lifestyle advisors, motivational speakers, they are New Age gurus who advise people how to live in the world with reference. They mix up modern ideas from modern psychology with ideas from Indian and Western and all kinds of wisdom traditions, as they call them. And in this way, they advise people to be compassionate, feeling empathetic, and so many terms which they don't usually define very clearly. Some of them are very famous, and Anthony Robbins, I've heard the name, I don't know what he teaches, I'm not in too much of a hurry to learn exactly what he teaches. I heard the name. This Stephen Covey, even though he's he must be out of fashion now, but still you see people in India reading his books. He's a Mormon, but he's New Age influenced also. All they're called New Age gurus. They teach people through their books and seminars how to live in the world. This, win-win. Stephen Covey's win-win. You deal with others in a way, not that you just dominate them and exploit them and try to get what you can get out of them, so that you both win. Of course, we learn from Bhagavad Gita that the actual situation of this material world is that all endeavors in it are lose-lose for everyone. So it's just a big illusion that there's win-win. There might be, in some cases, a possibility of apparent win-win, but it's parabhavastavadabodhajata yavanna jignyasata atmatatvam. As long as you're thinking, let us win in this world, then we are certain to be defeated in it. Because the real purpose is to inquire into the nature of the soul, the ultimate reality. So, consciousness raising. We cannot deny that some consciousness raising is there. Vegetarianism, there's this Pita Society, I think it's pronounced, people for empathetic treatment of animals, and they go around and show people the horrors of the slaughterhouse and why you should be a vegetarian. People who are into organic food, including organic chicken, organic pork, organic beef. So this is all consciousness raising. See, it's better to eat organic meat than non-organic meat. So it's preserve the environment, save the whale, Greenpeace, save the seals, be good, be nice, etc. So this is all consciousness raising. Is it not a good thing? Well, let us examine this question. And now, in the style of a good New Age seminar, we'll have a slide. This is the first time I ever did this, actually. No, I have given slideshows of deities, but not an educational slideshow. I even designed the slides by myself. How about that? I might become as popular as Anthony Robbins. Not very likely. Please clean filter. Please clean your muddy consciousness. Can you get that please clean filter out? It's In 5 or 6 seconds it will go. By the meditation of the yogi there, it will simply vanish. Here's an instance of, that reminds me, there's a book by the author of Jonathan Livingstone Seagull or something like that. Spark or something. Richard Bach, yeah. So he wrote another book, very small book, about how you, just by concentrating enough, you can make the clouds disappear. And many people believe that. There's this book by Napoleon Hill called Think and Grow Rich. That if you just think, you just meditate on it, and you really desire it, then you will become rich. And in that same strain, Richard Bach wrote a book. Any idea what the title was? Anyway, it was something. I read most of it. I skimmed through it. It's a very small book. You can look it up on the internet if you want. It doesn't matter. How it's a story of how one person, who's like a guru, teaches the other to make the He's looking at the cloud in the sky, and he just concentrates and concentrates, and by his concentration the cloud just vanishes. So there's this idea that's one of the prevalent ideas of New Age, that you can just, by your thought, you can shape the world. And shape. There are many ideas like this. This Yogi Mahesh, transcendental meditation, his idea that by people, so-called transcendental meditation, that by doing meditation, that the consciousness of the world will be improved. Everything will become better. Like this. So, what have we got now here? Alright. There's the material world and the spiritual world. And although this man sitting here looks like he's meditating like a yogi, he's a conditioned soul. There's the spiritual world with Krishna. The spiritual world means pure consciousness. I lost my notes for this, so now we got. Now I designed the slide, but I lost the notes. So now I'm ad-libbing. Hope we have a good presentation there. So in the spiritual world, there is the realm of pure consciousness, chidvilasa. In the material world means darkness, ignorance, forgetfulness of Krishna, illusion. Yeah, okay, what's the next? Next. The material world is typified, defined by lower consciousness. The prominent symptoms of the material world are lust. The spiritual world is defined by prema. The material world is defined by lust. That atendriya priti vancha tare bale kam krishnendriya priti ichad. Hare Prema Man. The material world, everyone is simply thinking how to satisfy their own senses. This is called lust. Whereas the spiritual reality is the nature of prema, where all desires are simply for Krishna's pleasure. So this material world, it is symptomized by lust or desire for satisfaction. Self-satisfaction, making oneself, considering oneself the center of reality. Then, what else is there? Greed, which is concomitant with lust. It's a further extension of lust, that I will gather more and more for myself, more and more chattels or material objects, more and more people, followers, money, the consuming. Bhogi. Bhog means, it's often translated to enjoy. It means to consume. I am the consumer. I need unlimited material for my unlimited desire to consume. Then, what else have we got in the material world? It's the world of exploitation, where one living being tries to exploit another. Everyone is trying to take advantage of others, to get others to be in his own service. In the dream of Ishvaroham Aham Bhogi. So exploitation is a prominent symptom. These are all symptoms of the material world, lower consciousness, and sin. There is sin. Forbidden activity. Actually, the whole consciousness of the material world, of considering oneself separate from Krishna, is sinful. So the whole material world is characterized by sin. Apart from everything being sinful, there are some specific activities which are considered particularly sinful, such as maintaining slaughterhouses or illicit sexual relations, gambling, intoxication, failing to respect persons who should be respected, telling untruths generally, stealing, murder. These are all various sins. So this is the lower consciousness of the material world, then, yeah, that drags us down to hell. Down, down, down. It's a downward spiral. Trividham narakasyedam dwaram nashanam atmanaha kamas krodhas tatha lobhas tasmat etat trayantyajet. Lust, greed, and anger are the three gates to hell. Therefore, they should be given up. Otherwise, we go to hell. Then, next. Higher consciousness. Within this material world, there are various persons who are trying to cultivate a higher consciousness. And we find all over the world, throughout history, whatever tiny little bit of history is known in the modern world, it only goes back maybe 3,000 or 4,000 years. They really know very, very little. But we find there are various civilizations in which they're organized with rules and regulations. There is art, science, the quest for knowledge. This is higher consciousness. And there are religious systems or moral systems. Not only religious systems in the world, there are also moral systems. Confucianism is not a religious system as such, but it's a moral system. Buddhism could also be considered a moral system. There's no recognition of anything spiritual within Buddhism. There's no recognition of anything at all. So then higher consciousness. What are symptoms of higher consciousness? Respect for others. These are some examples of offering respect to others, which is prominent in the present world, it's quite prominent in Asian cultures as compared to the West. That even in the modern world, we'll find in most of Asia, maybe not China, I'm not sure, but respect is visibly showing respect to others is a prominent part of the culture in India, Bangladesh, Thailand, for instance. It's bowing to others, touching their feet, showing respect to others. Respect for... Of course, respect is always there, just like probably the most respected person in Britain is a footballer called, or ex-footballer called David Beckham. So he's also respected. But not respect for the wrong reasons. But people... In Vedic culture, people are respected first and foremost for their spiritual status, for their learning. Learning means a Vedic knowledge. And then there are various criteria for their knowledge, for their spiritual status manifested as their anabhishvanga, asaktya anabhishvanga, putra dara griha dishu, their detachment from that which is most people are attached to, namely children, wife, home, and the rest. So detachment, austerity, then age. Among Shudras, age is the only criterion for respect by their caste. And then all over the world, money and power are respected. And among women, especially beauty. So that is not a symptom of higher consciousness, because animals also, there's in a pack of dogs, the most vicious dog is the most respected. So to respect someone because they're powerful does not constitute in and of itself higher consciousness. So next. Concern for others, not being simply self-centered. This is a symptom of higher consciousness. Somewhat higher, because again, among the animals even, that may be there. But one's concern for others, just like this Greenpeace movement or Save the Whales, which I just spoke about in a somewhat sardonic manner or sarcastic manner. But there is concern for other living beings, that with this planet is not only inhabited by humans. We're all in this together. If we don't, it's something like dharma rakshati rakshataha. Those who protect dharma are protected by dharma. So unless we protect all the different species, we ourselves are going to be in a big mess, because there's all of nature is interlinked, and we can't meddle around with it. Otherwise, it'd be a big mess for everyone. So concern for others. This is a symptom of higher consciousness. Respect for all life. Yeah, I just touched on that. Yeah? Okay, go on. Vegetarianism as opposed to omnivorism. Just eating whatever, anything and everything. What is the cause of this? How is that happening? It's so loose. Well, how about getting an electrician to put the wire tight? It's a pin. How about changing the pin? Could you look into that? Solve this. I mean, it's just quite a problem, isn't it? Every few minutes we get this horrible noise. So, in the Western world, the culture until recently was one of omnivorism, which means eating meat and other things. When we say meat-eaters, it doesn't mean they only eat meat. But they eat meat and other things also. From my childhood, which we could say, about 40 years ago, as I was becoming vegetarian, at that time it was in England, it was considered weird, crazy, strange, wrong, etc. It wasn't considered something very good. Although in India also, some people, if they try to become vegetarians, they may have that response also nowadays. English people pride themselves on being beef eaters. That particular word, beef eater, that's with pride. The British are beef eaters. But then in the supplement magazine of the Sunday Telegraph, which is the most conservative newspaper of Britain, I saw, this was maybe 15 years ago, that how in the last few years Britain's culture has undergone a major change from being beef eaters to being vegetarians. It's undergoing, and still Britain is more, significantly more than America or other countries in Europe. People have become and are becoming vegetarians. Usually not for ethical reasons. Usually because when they find out that the meat's got so many chemicals in it that are liable to cause you all kinds of diseases, and that red meat especially is highly likely to cause various problems, serious problems such as cancer, blood pressure, which can lead to heart problems, heart attacks. So for health reasons, many people become vegetarians. But when they become vegetarians, they often just by being vegetarian, there is a, that by doing so, it not, I can't really say that becoming a vegetarian lifts you to a higher consciousness, but it removes the the cause of the lower consciousness, or one ceases to be in that matrix of a meat-eating lower, or the effects of that lower consciousness, which comes by eating meat. So often people who become vegetarians for health reasons, they start to appreciate the ethical reasons, and they think that, well, actually, it's not nice, is it, killing all those animals? They're also living beings. They also suffer. So we can these points of higher consciousness, these are also coming in through New Age. Just like people, martial arts, for instance, people who learn karate or jujitsu, which I recently saw Prabhupada said that he was commenting on yuyutsavaha, the word from Bhagavad Gita. He said this term has become, in Japanese, jujitsu, judo. So people who are taught that, they're not the ones who are going to go out and be the hooligans who smash up the city, because along with the training, you have to learn mental self-control so that you only use it in a proper way, and they have to learn respect for the guru or the teacher. So respect for others, along with this watered down Indian culture or Asian culture that's come, some things have come through, some respect for the teacher that may be there to some extent. Concern for others, respect for all life, that we see that in the, just like the Greenpeace, save the whales, save the seals, vegetarianism. So these are all good signs. And a philosophical approach to life. Well, we could say that to some extent about New Ageism. That's at a long stretch. Then what else? Reincarnation. It's not written there? Not interested in gross materialism. Yeah, well, we see that some people, due to or their New Age influences, or they become attracted to that because they see that the whole of modern society is grossly materialistic, and they think, well, there may be better things. We don't have to. We can live simply, we can appreciate the nature and appreciate other people, we can appreciate music, and we shouldn't be grossly, they're not attracted to the grossly materialistic way of life. Also, in New Ageism, it's New Ages, almost all accept the concept of reincarnation. So these are all steps forward, are they not? This is raising consciousness. It's higher. To accept reincarnation is higher than to think that we're born, then we die, and then it's all finished. Or then we're born and we die, and then we wait around in a fridge for some time, and then God comes and judges us all. And Some the lucky ones get the ticket to heaven, and the rest get a ticket to hell. So an understanding of reincarnation. Not really an understanding, that's a problem. They don't understand it. But they believe in it, even without understanding the science of it. All right, so let's look at the next slide. Bhakti yoga is the process by which we can go from lower consciousness directly up to the spiritual world and burst through the coverings of the universe, go beyond the higher consciousness of respect for others, concern for others, respect for all life, vegetarianism, philosophical approach to life, not interested in gross materialism, reincarnation, etc., 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 and actually come to the actual consciousness of the jiva, which is Jive Surup Hoy Krishna Nityadas Jai. All right, let's have a little celebration of that. Chant Hare Krishna for a few minutes. And in the meantime, I'll come back and speak a little bit more about all of this. Yeah, so this process of bhakti yoga, by which one can come even from lower consciousness right up to the highest consciousness, which takes us directly up to the spiritual world, is described throughout the Vaishnava literature. Anartho pashamang sakshad bhakti yoga madhokshaje. The anarthas, or everything which is of lower consciousness, we can get relief from that by direct devotional service to Adhoksaja, the transcendent Lord. So from the very beginning, bhakti yoga puts us in contact with the level, the highest level of consciousness, that level of consciousness which is in the higher consciousness of this world. It is aiming at that, but without a clear understanding of it. That's why the concern for others, for instance, in this material world, can never be on the level of the devotee's concern for others. It can never be as beneficial. It can never actually help others because of lack of proper knowledge. That's why Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur said that the neophyte ringing the bell in the temple, he's doing so, is far more beneficial for all living beings, both materially and spiritually, than opening millions of hospitals. From the hospital, people are benefited. But it's the point that he's making there, Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati, is that it is of no ultimate benefit to everyone. Another example is that of saving the shirt of the drowning man. It seems absurd, doesn't it? Well, it's just as absurd to try to help others on the material platform, because it doesn't ultimately help them at all. And in fact, by the concern for others and the desire to help them, that reinforces the bodily concept of life by thinking we have helped them by repairing their bodies so that they can go on with life and enjoy life more and more in forgetfulness of Krishna. That's what they don't know. It actually reinforces the mundane welfare work, although it may appear to be beneficial to others, is actually harmful to them, because it reinforces the concept that there is any benefit beyond Krishna consciousness, surrender to Krishna. Tomara charan bina kichu dhan shangshare ar kichu nai. We just sung. There is nothing of actual benefit beyond Krishna. So all the good qualities in this world, they ultimately come to zero, as is described in Srimad Bhagavatam. Yasya asti bhakti bhagavate kinchana sarvai gunais tatra samasite suraha harav abhaktasya kato mahan guna manoratena asiti dhavato bihi. That all godly qualities are manifest in the personages of akinchan devotees, devotees who don't have any material aspirations. So those who are akinchan, their akinchan means without something. They don't have anything to do with this material world because they're linked with adhoksaja, the Supreme Lord who is beyond this material world. Whereas those who are not devotees of Krishna, they may have some qualities. They may have concern for others, vegetarian, interested in spiritual life, etc., etc., etc. But that may be considered a quality, but it's not a mahan gun. It's not a developed or a great quality. Just some other examples, backtracking a bit here. In New Age also, Ayurveda, massage, Reiki, alternative systems of healing, balanced diet, these are all some other symptoms of higher consciousness. It's certainly higher consciousness to take a balanced vegetarian diet than go to McDonald's and pick up hamburger and chips. And then Ayurveda is more sattvic than generally. I mean, there's meat preparations also in Ayurveda. I mean, there are medicines which are also made from killing animals in Ayurveda. But generally, it's definitely a less gross science than that of the modern allopathic system. So, the bhakti yoga, that from the very beginning, the aim is clear. The aim is clear because Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. It's not a difficult concept to understand. Whereas in Mayavad and in New Age, vagueness is considered a quality. That the ultimate is indescribable, ineffable, and vague terms. And the feelings. So, from the very beginning, bhakti yoga, it is otherworldly, that means it's not of this world, but it's realistic and practical. This is the bhakti yoga process of going to the spiritual world is described in Chaitanya Charitamrita. That nitya siddha krishna prema shardha kapu noi shavanadi shuddha chite koreyo doi. That Krishna consciousness is the natural propensity of every living being. It lies dormant within everyone's consciousness, covered by karma, material desire, which occupies the mind, the intelligence, and the senses. But that, by Shravana and Kirtan, the dormant consciousness that I am the servant of Krishna is revived. So this Shravan Kirtan is the system for reviving that, but prior to that, one has to be initiated, one has to be brought to this process. Brahmanda Brahmite Kono Kono Bhagyavan Jeev Guru Krishna Prasade Pai Bhakti Lata Bij. Someone who is fortunate, they will get the seed of desire to develop or to take to the bhakti yoga process. So that bhakti lata bij, that is to be watered, the watering process is shravana kirtan. Having received instruction and continuing to receive instruction from Guru, then the bhakti lata develops. Now, the bhakti lata, it's not shown here. Lata means a creeper or a vine. So it grows up taking support. It has support. And if the support is a bona fide support and is linked with the spiritual world, then the lata, as it grows up and up and up and up, it will eventually, as described in Chaitanya Charitamrita, pierce through the coverings of the material universe, go all the way to Golok Vrindavan, and take shelter at the lotus feet of Krishna, where it is now ready to give the fruit of the vine, which is the fruit of love of Krishna, Krishna prema. Whereas, next, Mayavad, it goes up, its consciousness raising, but it doesn't go toward Krishna. It's definitely going up, its consciousness raising, but it's not toward Krishna. It doesn't aim toward Krishna. So even in its going up, the seed of its downfall is already there. Because ignoring Krishna, which is this, even though there's a higher consciousness, there, among genuine, you may say genuine impersonalists, there's a spiritual seeking, but then they've not come to the point of Krishna, of accepting Krishna as their shelter. So they don't have any shelter. They don't have the shelter of Krishna. It's their own endeavor by which they go up. They think that by developing higher consciousness, I myself will become the reservoir of higher consciousness. They're very ambitious. That is not a higher consciousness. The idea that I myself shall become one with the highest consciousness is a very low, mean, degraded, insulting idea. So, although they have some idea of higher consciousness, it's mixed with the base idea, which is the foundation of our existence in material life. So they're going up on their own strengths, but they don't have shelter. So if an impersonalist slips, he's in trouble. Whereas if a devotee, he slips, he's being pulled up. The devotee goes up, he's, by taking shelter at the lotus feet of those who are already up, they pull him up. And even if he slips, Krishna and his devotees will pull the devotee up. Whereas the impersonalist, he's on his own. He doesn't have any shelter. He doesn't have any clear direction. He can go up to the Brahma Jyoti, but yenye ravindaksha vimuktamaninas, they become liberated, but not fully or properly liberated. They're not properly situated. To be situated in the Brahma Jyoti is not to be, that means we may be in a higher consciousness beyond this material world of exploitation, sukh and dukh, happiness and distress. We may be beyond that, but they may think, I am now fully liberated. But they only think like that, because they're not in the proper position. Vimuktinanas twayasta bhavad avishuddha buddhaya. Their consciousness is not properly purified. In many ways they're purified, yes. We don't kill animals, and we're tolerant of various situations, and we're concerned with others. And in so many ways, their consciousness is purified. And they're also purified by their austerities. Aruhya kritrena. They take great difficulty to go to parampadam. But tataha, from there, tata patanti. They patanti adaha. They fall down. Patanti adho. Anadrita yushmadangraya, because they have the fault of not worshipping Krishna's lotus feet. So they must fall down. They're going up. It's actually an illusion. They're not really going up at all. We can say they're going up. In one sense, yes, they are going up. But in another sense, They're going up with carrying the rock that's going to pull them down. So they go down, they come down. They must fall down into this material world. And then, once you're in the material world, you can go all the way down to hell. And down and down and down. Because you have no fixed position. Asatyam apratishtam te. Because they don't accept Krishna as Satya, then they don't have any solid basis. And therefore, the endeavors of the impersonalists, and I'm talking here about the real impersonalists, the ones who really take the tapasya and take the difficulty, they're the ones that are going to the Brahmajyoti. These New Age people, they're not going anywhere near the Brahmajyoti. Let's look at them next. New Age. Yeah, it's going up. It's going up. Higher consciousness. Going up. And it's going off in all different directions. What do we see there? What's the next one? Yeah, but there are also all kinds of funny ideas mixed up with that, such as feminism. Equal rights, because they have no clear understanding of the difference between material and spiritual, that they think that they don't understand the difference between worldly dharma and transcendence. That in the material world, there are certain gradations which are to be observed if one is actually going to come to higher consciousness. And so they have the idea of equal rights, feminism, democracy. In the Western world, it's considered practically sacrosanct, democracy. Everyone should be democratic. I mean, we can go and attack countries and kill people just to make them democratic, at least as the excuse. It's considered so worthy that everyone has equal rights. But that doesn't... Anyway, I'm not going to talk about it now, but it's a misunderstanding. I'm not going to get into that right now. That everyone... just to give a little example, as Srila Prabhupada pointed out, why should the university professor and the uneducated person have the same vote? One is supposed to understand the issues and the other can't even begin to understand them. So these are prominent. Feminism, promotion of homosexuality, gay rights, that everyone should... like I say, this is mainstream also. That they are, because of the not understanding the codes of the Supreme Lord, which are given in this world, then they promote that, well, you know, it's all feelings and it's how you feel, it's not what you do. So what is the harm if two people love each other? They use words like love, peace, compassion, kindness, be cool, care. But without any clear definition of what these terms mean. That we find that the Vaishnavas, they very carefully define all these words. Just like that. What is love? Just love. Love for all living beings. Krishna says that. Advaishta sarva bhutanam maitra karuna evacha. But what does that love mean? But the Vaishnavas define this atendriya Priti vancha tare bale kam krishnendriya priti icha dhare premanam. What is the difference between material love and spiritual love? There is a very great difference. You just say love, you just love everyone, and then they rush up and embrace someone, never mind one's male and one's female, and they're not married. And even male and female in civilized society don't embrace in public. They don't even talk to each other in public. Practically, husband and wife in civilized society. So many misunderstandings because they don't have clear knowledge of the differentiation of the difference between material and spiritual, nor do they have knowledge given by Bhagavan of how to live in this variegated world so that the consciousness can be raised to go to the variegated spiritual world. But they just have a vague idea of oneness, that the ultimate is one and therefore everything in this world is one. They make many mistakes which cause them to perform sinful activities. But that's another thing. In Neo-Mayavad, in traditional Mayavad, they follow rules of dharma. And in modern Mayavad or New Age, they speak of dharma, but it's nebulous. Nothing's clear. They don't. One prominent symptom of the modern New Ageism is that there's no concept of sin. Nothing's sinful. Nothing's wrong. You shouldn't blame. You see, you can't blame anyone. You shouldn't be judgmental and say someone's done a sin or they've done something wrong. And therefore you get such absurd situations, whereas in Sweden, if someone's a criminal, they think, well, actually it's not really his fault, it's the society's fault for not having raised him properly. And then they have prisons where you can walk out if you like, and all kinds of things. It's just, in Sweden, I was there in 1979, I think, last time. I was selling some stupid records to raise funds, which we did very well for buying Sankirtan vehicles, which were very useful for preaching in Bangladesh. But the first time it happened, I can still remember, I approached a young woman who probably wasn't married with her young daughter, who was about 6 years old, and presented the record to her. For record, by the way, for those of you who are young, there used to be a system of... anyway, look it up in the dictionary if you don't know what it is. Recent modern social history. It's something you sell, which you play it back and it gives some musical sound, or something supposed to be musical. So, approaching a young woman who probably wasn't married with her daughter, who was about 6 years old, and presenting her the record that she can buy it. And then she turns to the daughter and asks, well, what do you think? And then they had a conversation between them. And it was the daughter who decided, because equal rights. You see, you can't train children because, you know, they're all equal rights. They're so extremely bizarre society. There's all New Age influences. When I say it's coming from the yogis and the West, but it's also mixed up with ideas. The first hippie in America is one of the founding fathers. What do you think? Thomas Jefferson. What he put into the culture of America was just... if you read it, it's like a hippie Bible or something. All these ideas. Well, that was influenced by the French also. French Revolution, all this kind of thing. Or did that come later? Anyway, whatever. Lack of restraint. Because, you know, everything's wonderful. Everything's good. So, you know, just do whatever you like. Everything's good. There's no bad. There's no sin. So you can have sex with anything. You can take any kind of intoxication. If it feels good, do it. This is New Age. Not the same as the old impersonalism, who are very strict in all these things. Lack of restraint. Then what else? This is a common saying in the West now, that it's fashionable to say that I am spiritual but not religious. I'm not affiliated to any institution, but I'm just spirit. I feel spiritual. I'm a spiritual person. I maybe do meditation sometimes, especially after smoking marijuana. And, you know, I read books on Zen Buddhism, and I'm a fan of the Dalai Lama, who's one of the... he probably eats significantly more meat than the average person in the world, daily. He's a big eater, and he eats a lot of meat every day. But he's a Buddhist, and he talks about peace And he smiles. And he's old and Asian. So, you're not a follower. You wouldn't call yourself a follower of him. But you like him. So, you might even have a guru who teaches you in this, you know, when you're out of your office, you go to your guru a couple of times a week who teaches you various Buddhist meditation techniques. And in this way, you are spiritual but not religious. No commitment means you just feel spiritual without any commitment. That's a big difference to the old impersonalists also. You get a secret mantra, yeah. Same one they give to everyone. Don't, but keep it secret, then otherwise everyone will find out. That actually happened, actually, once. One, before I was mercifully allowed to join this movement, one of my uncles told me that one of his friends had got this secret mantra, and then they divulged it to other people, and they all found out they'd all got the same secret mantra. It's like supposed to be your own personalized mantra, but it's just a bluff. Just a bluff. Well, of course, you get Asharam, who just asks you, well, what god do you want to worship? And then he gives you a mantra according to which god you want to worship. Very many bad ideas. So this idea of spiritual but not religious, no commitment. You just feel spiritual. No direction. Just whatever you feel like, as Vishnu Jan Prabhu, distributing books in America, told me that he often meets young people who he's distributed books to previously, Bhagavad Gita. And he asks them if they've read it. And sometimes they say no. Sometimes they say yes. But if they say yes, they usually say, but I only read the translation and not the commentary, because I don't want someone to give me their commentary. I'll get my own understanding myself just by my own reading. But the idea that, you know, here I am, some kid in America with no culture behind me, no religious culture, no training, no understanding of the deep principles on which Bhagavad Gita is written. In Bhagavad Gita, Lord Krishna himself states, Bahunam jandanamante gyanavam mam prapadyate. After many births, someone who's cultivated Vedic knowledge for many lifetimes may come to the actual point. So here's someone with no knowledge, no background, and it takes the Bhagavad Gita from a person who is shabde pare cha nishna tam ramanya pashama shrayam, who is completely immersed in transcendental sound, and who's taken shelter of that supreme reality. And here's someone, and I'm not going to take their commentary. I'll do it my do it yourself spiritualism. The rugged individual. Yeah, I'll work it out myself. I'm spiritual, so I can understand by myself. Incredible arrogance, which gets you nowhere. Extraordinarily arrogant, the idea, I will do it all by myself. But even to read the translation, then you're also influenced, because in the translation also comes the idea. Then what will you do? Then you have to learn Sanskrit, so you can read it by yourself. But even learning Sanskrit, you'll be influenced by the consciousness of the teacher. You can't avoid being taught. And we're taught throughout life, from the very beginning. We can't say, I'll just work it out all by myself. Interestingly, it's common in the West for people to say, it's very common for people in the West to say this, that I'll work it all out by myself, I don't need anyone to guide me. Why is it more common there than in other places? Because that idea has been propagated by other people. They got that idea from someone else that I shouldn't learn from anyone else. So they are being influenced. They think it's my, You know, I have my own idea to just do it by myself, but why is it more in America and in the Western world? Because it's been propagated there by idiots like who's this J. Krishnamurti, who wrote his book, in his book that you don't read any books. Don't take guidance from anyone. Actually, I saw once a Stephen Covey book in the office of one of our temple presidents. It wasn't The Seven Habits, some other book. So I just opened it. In the middle of the book, it had Stephen Covey's version of the self-realized person, according to Stephen Covey, all the characteristics of him. So it gave the characteristics that, he exercises regularly, and he listens empathetically to others. And then in this list, there was one thing. He does not have anyone as his guru, is in the list. But you're taking guidance from him about, by reading that book, you're taking guidance to mold your life. So he is your guru in that sense, but he doesn't have anyone as his guru. All hypocritical, contradictory, nonsensical. But people think that this is spiritual, and that it's undefined. They think undefined is spiritual. No rules is spiritual. That you just imagine yourself to be spiritual. Just imagination. Is that the end of it? Okay. So, yeah, keep it up. Is New Age consciousness right? Is it something beneficial or not? Well, like many facets of reality or many points that can be examined philosophically, we can see from different perspectives. I spoke on this some time ago, about 2 years ago, something like that. It's how the apparent contradictions in Shastra can be understood, that just like in Bhagavad Gita, for instance, Lord Krishna speaks about how you should worship the demigods and later condemns it. So both are correct. Or I'm not going to give the same whole lecture now, but just like you, someone who's just starting to come to Krishna consciousness, and he tells you that, well, I'm chanting one round a day now. You say, oh, very good, very good. Someone else who's an initiated devotee comes up and says, I'm chanting one round a day now. Oh, that's very bad. Same thing. But for one person, it's good. It's a step up. And for someone else, it's a step down. So, overall, is it good? Or not? Well, we have to see if ultimately people can be brought to Krishna consciousness. In some ways, people are brought up, but they're not brought in. They're going up, but they're not going toward Krishna. And in some ways, to bring them toward Krishna may be more difficult than people who haven't got this supposedly higher consciousness. Because they think that they're already there. They think they're already on the way to where they're already at where they should be going to. And generally, it produces people have they put on a show of being humble, but they're actually extremely puffed up. The idea that I'm spiritual but not religious. I'll work it all out by myself. That ultimately we have to become one with everything, or we are already one with everything. It's completely antithetical to understanding Krishna consciousness. So, on the other hand, it's good that people are becoming vegetarians. But we need to teach Krishna consciousness very clearly and strongly, and not get mixed up in people's minds with this New Age mush, candy floss. Not get mixed up with that. We may think, well, it's good people are taking interest in Bhagavad Gita, but if they take interest in it in the way of Dr. Radha Krishna, in that, with that kind of understanding, well, to get them out of that, you're going to have to work, just like Prabhupada. You could say the people, they came to him, but what he had to do, I mean, day after day after day, giving them prasadam, getting them to chant, teaching them, and eventually having to yell at them, and still he didn't get out of Kirtanandi. I mean, even though he became initiated in a guru, he still, that Mayavad was still very strong in his heart, and it may be that those who were his followers, they're also very much influenced by that, as appears to be so. So it's a very deep disease. So, well, whether it's good or whether it's not, for both classes, people who are not inclined toward New Age and those who are, we need to preach very, very strong, very, very clearly the principles of Bhakti Yoga. And Srila Prabhupada was quite clear that he didn't want our devotees to be mixed up in the minds of others with these Mayavadi gurus. He didn't want that. He didn't want people to think that the Hare Krishna movement is another movement from India which subscribes to the idea of ultimately everything is all one. So, good in some ways? Maybe yes, but it's not, ultimately it's not very helpful for our preaching Krishna consciousness. We may find that people inclined to New Age, they'll come and chant Hare Krishna with us maybe more easily than others do, but then in what consciousness are they doing? If they come and chant Hare Krishna with us, or maybe we go and chant with them nowadays, is more likely. But then understanding why we are chanting, the consciousness of the Mayavadi chanting Hare Krishna and the consciousness of the devotee is completely different. And devotees are warned not to hear the chanting of Mayavadis, which acts like poison. The chanting of Hare Krishna purifies the heart, Chaito Darpana Marajanam, and leads us to the ocean of bliss, who is Krishna. But the chanting of Mayavadis simply reinforces their enviousness and offensiveness toward Krishna. Therefore we are warned not to associate with Mayavadis and not to hear the Hari Kirtan, supposed Hari Kirtan of Mayavadis. So we may say, well, more and more people are chanting Hare Krishna. So that if we can get more and more people to chant, but actually we're not just trying to get people to chant, but we want them to understand why they're doing what they're doing. We see that Srila Prabhupada, generally, when he met people, he didn't ask them to chant Hare Krishna, surprisingly. You might be surprised to hear that. It's not that when people came, Prabhupada would say, here, chant, start chanting. But he would speak philosophy to them and try to get them to understand. And then on the basis of that understanding, to start chanting. He wouldn't just tell them to start chanting. You can see so many conversations that have Prabhupada. He would give them a philosophical understanding, first of all, that we have to understand what is our position. So there are some thoughts. Is it conclusive? No. Is consciousness raising? Yeah, we can say it's raising, but it's not raising toward Krishna. So ultimately it has to, it's not, it's only an illusion of going up. It's not, it's, well, it's going up, but it's not going up to Krishna. So everything that goes up must come down, unless it gets shelter at the feet of Krishna. It's going up, it's like the Ferris wheel. It goes up. You go up in it, but it must come down. There's no way that you can, as long as one is not in the consciousness of being a servant of Krishna, then one must remain trapped. Then, by definition, that is material consciousness. One cannot come out of material consciousness without actually entering the spiritual atmosphere, which means to surrender to Krishna. Therefore, we see Srila Prabhupada was so insistent and direct in his preaching, because even if people do become vegetarians, and even if they do chant Hare Krishna, unless they have a clear understanding of who is Krishna, it's not going to help them very much. Our aim is not to produce millions of Mayavadis chanting Hare Krishna. That is not the success of our movement. Our aim is if even one person can become a pure devotee. That's what Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati said. If even one person can become a pure devotee. So, any questions or comments about this? Is Ram Narasimha, is he here? No, I suggested that he come because he was preaching in the... Ram Narasimha Prabhu! What happened? You got merged in the New Age there? Oh, I see. I called your name. Usually people... Everyone likes to hear their own name. Usually they respond quickly. You're completely given up false ego. Krishna likes to hear his own name also. He's pleased when we chant it. But if we chant his name thinking, Krishna, I'm going to dance on your head, he doesn't like that. I'm going to take you over. Yeah, so you had a lot of experience preaching in England that really strongly influenced by New Ageism. I didn't give a very thorough exposition of New Age. I don't really know what it is that much because I've been in India. But it could be a study how, like, you know, I was saying, like, Jefferson, democracy, human, it's not only coming from India. It's a real mix-up. Yeah, so please. We have another mic or not? Yeah. Right. Yeah, it's not that everyone who ever reads Hermann Hesse's book is on the strength of that doomed to hell forever. It's not that everyone's hopeless. And there can be techniques to catch them and bring them in the kind... speaking the language which, if you immediately say to them, you have to surrender to Krishna, it's unlikely to work. So there may be in the beginning some kind of presentation that we are something like that, but you should take them pretty quickly to the real thing. Otherwise, if you I've discussed this so many times, especially in the West, people talk about bridge preaching, but the point is, if you're going to go on a bridge to people on the other side, you have to take them onto the bridge and back to this side of the bridge. Not that you remain forever on the bridge, so that they think that the bridge is the ultimate, or that you cross to the other side and stay there. So there's nothing wrong with bridge preaching. All preaching is bridge preaching, actually. Because, like I say, it's not that you just say, surrender to Krishna. Okay, it doesn't happen. All preaching means to communicate with people at the level of consciousness that they're at, to grab their attention, and to bring that attention toward Krishna. That's all preaching is bridge preaching. Some is called bridge preaching because it is deliberately circuitous in its approach. But the point is, it should not remain on that level very long. Otherwise, it's also very dangerous for devotees if they're talking about yoga and love and peace and all this. If they become used to that, then you start to think like that also. Like I say, you go over the bridge and you stay there yourself. That's the problem. Yeah. They become so much into Reiki and gemstones and astrology and all these things, which are not necessarily bad in themselves. But instead of thinking in terms of what Krishna tells us in Bhagavad Gita, we think that, well, Reiki is going to solve all the problems. The real problem in this temple is we need a few gemstones put around here. What we need to do is knock all the walls down and put in doors here and close the doors over there, and then everything will be okay. So they think that they can solve. They see the world in terms of Ayurveda, astrology, Vastu, Reiki, or whatever, instead of Krishna's teachings. Yeah. It is common. You can preach to people through astrology, but then if you become more into astrology than Krishna, and it's easier to relate to people on that level, and they love it, and they respect you on that level, but then you have to take them and say that this is not the ultimate. You have to take them from that to Krishna. Yeah, you wanted to say something? It's all very influential. When I said the West, I was about England and America, but Croatia also. All the young people. I mentioned the Hermann Hesse book, actually, because for two reasons. Because once I was on a bus in Northern Ireland, and I saw some young man opposite reading a Hermann Hesse book. And I started speaking with him. And he said that all the young people, because Northern Ireland means Catholic and Protestant. And the young people, they're fed up of it. Especially those who are little intelligent. And he said that among the young people now, he said it's not Catholic or Protestant. It's everyone's into Eastern things. And in my own experience, I only ever read one Hermann Hesse book. It was the last Kami book I read before joining the movement. It was Siddhartha, I think it was. And it leads up and leads up and leads up. And then it just, in the last page, just comes this completely impersonal conclusion. You know, you think you're going to get something, some realization or something. And then it just says, he saw Agni and he was Indra, he was Agni and this and that. So I was actually on a boat from Wales to Ireland, and it was quite a nice summer. I was sitting on the deck. Then I finished the book, and in disgust, I threw it in the sea. More of this. I didn't even know the word impersonalism, but I was disgusted by it. That was my good fortune. And more of this vague stuff, which with no proper, no clear understanding. So that anyway, yeah. Do we go if we're invited to Mayavadi meetings?
How do we behave there if you go?
Well, we have to take it on a case-by-case basis. Srila Prabhupada, let's look to his example. He is our Acharya. When he first came from the West with his Western disciples returned, then he would attend such programs. And he wouldn't... they would make him be last, because him and the Western devotees were the attraction. So they had his program last. So they had to sit through all these Mayavadis and probably just sit there chanting on his beads, having to listen to all this nonsense. And then he would have kirtan at the end. He didn't speak much. But then later he would do his own programs when he had more devotees, some infrastructure. He would do his own Pandav programs. In Japan, where the movement wasn't developed, I think there were just like two or three devotees. He was invited, some Indian supporters invited them to some program, and first of all, this Mayavadi was speaking, because it was their guru. So Prabhupada, he was speaking in Hindi, and then Prabhupada was sitting, and Prabhupada was supposed to speak after. At some point, Prabhupada just said to his disciples, "Stop him!" And then they all started performing kirtan right in the middle of his lecture. And the man who had invited them, who was supposed to give them land for a temple and everything, he was completely fried out. And then Prabhupada spoke, and then he spoke against all this Mayavad, and they were completely fried out. So Prabhupada said, anyway, at some point they will appreciate how we have chastised them for all their nonsense. So Prabhupada knew, he burned them out. But they, Prabhupada, he couldn't just sit and tolerate all that. So how do we do it? I don't know. Sometimes people invite me and I tell them, look, like one time in London, I was invited to a Sai Baba temple. And I said, look, it's dangerous for you. Because it's going to be very difficult for me not to say anything. They said, well, look, we don't have any other place in this area. So, you know, just don't say anything about Sai Baba. I said, okay. So I gave a whole lecture. I didn't say anything about Sai Baba. Then at the end of the lecture, someone said something challenging. This is all Hindus. It's Pandavasena. You know, he was pretty aggressive with me, and I got aggressive back with him. And I said, look, what do you think you're talking about so much? Look at what you're worshipping. And I gestured. I didn't say anything about Sai Baba. I just said it. And I said a few things about Sai Baba without mentioning his name. That happened to be the owner of the temple. And the programs were terminated. And the devotee who was organizing it was upset with me. But I said, don't worry. If you really want to serve Krishna, Krishna will give you better facility. But he was fed up. He was really upset with me. It's actually after that incident, I decided to write my essay on speaking strongly in Prabhupada's service, because I was so fed up of people telling me not to speak the truth. So anyway, a year later I came back to London and I happened to see that devotee again. And I mentioned that incident to him. He said, well, actually it is much better, because we did get a much better place with much better facility, and now we don't have to be in a Sai Baba temple. So it did work out for the best, ultimately. So... but there are considerations also. It's just like, you have to see. If you go to a Mayavadi ashram and you're like guests there, then that might not be proper to start attacking them. Like we had a Shravan Kirtan camp in Bharuch at some Mayavadi ashram. So then we spoke. I didn't even go to see them. We just rented the place. But then they called us, all the Mayavadi Swamis, please come and see us. So we all went there. We spoke with them some pleasantries for a few minutes, gave them some Prabhupada's books. Then we did kirtan for how long? Almost an hour, I think it was, wasn't it? And one of the Swamis kind of liked it, and the others were just tolerating it. But the actual Mayavadis who follow some principles, we can respect them for that, as Chaitanya Mahaprabhu did. We can respect them for following Vedic culture for studying the Vedas, for following principles. We may respect them for that, but with their philosophy, we don't. It's better not to mix with them. If we're invited with programs with them, why should we go, actually? Maybe if there's a good opportunity for book distribution, we could do that. Generally, these big Mayavadis, they don't like our devotees coming and distributing books at their programs. There's Asaram, he doesn't like it. He doesn't like our movement at all. And there are many others like that also. But along with distributing our books, we should do programs and preach and make it clear what our philosophy is.
Sometimes actually this new age becomes wrongly or misunderstood or wrongly understood by devotees to be golden age.
The new age they think is golden age? No, new age, golden age means chanting Hare Krishna, pure devotees. The age of Aquarius. What is this nonsense? Did someone imagine this? What is this age of Aquarius? They talk about this age of Aquarius. New age is a revival of spiritual. It's a symptom of the golden age. No, it's a contamination, actually. They don't read Prabhupada's books. That's the problem. If you don't read Prabhupada's books, then you'll have so many problems. And you have to read them in the spirit of submission also. If you read them like a university scholar, then it won't help you. Yeah. Well, your comments are usually... All right, go on, say. Yeah, all right, but it's not really on the subject. I'm going to finish now. You can speak, you ask Shyamananda if you have any questions. He knows so many things. He can answer. I how long are we going to go on? All right, you want to speak something? No, that was Vidvan, he quoted that. You said that in your lecture, that Prabhupada said to Tamal Krishna Maharaj, what was that you quoted? You should know that these academic scholars, they're all big, big animals. You should give me that quote. I mean, Prabhupada didn't only say the academic scholars were animals. I mean, any... But... should get us the quote, yeah. We can read it out. So, we'll finish. You want to say something else? Or not? All right. Yeah. No, then they may not. But Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, the question is, if they're offensive from the beginning, the Mayavadis, how do they go to the Brahma Jyoti? Chaitanya Mahaprabhu said, Mayavadi Krishna Yaparadhi. That specifically refers to those like Dr. Radha Krishna, who ended up as a vegetable for all his big philosophical brain. I mean, he became what they call a vegetable in old age. He couldn't. His sensory perception and his brain function were just stopped. But there may be impersonalists who do. I mean, says in Shastra, Aruhya Kritraina Parang Padam, by great endeavor, they may go to the... So that's described also, that if there's a little tinge of Krishna Bhakti, then by the grace of that, they can achieve their desired goal. But the basic understanding is wrong. So they go to the spiritual world, but they have no standing there. They can go, but they're it's like they're there, but they're not really there, because they're not in the atmosphere of service to Krishna. They're not in the atmosphere of Satchidananda, although they think they are. So they're there, but they're not really there. It's just like, for instance, if I've never been to Afghanistan in this lifetime, and I'm not particularly eager to go there either. I guess someone should go and preach there. But I have flown over Afghanistan in the daytime and saw what it looks like from above. So at that time you could say I was in Afghanistan when we were flying over. But I wasn't really there. I didn't really have any contact with life in Afghanistan. So that's a rough example that just came to my mind. That you're there in the spiritual world, but you don't really have any contact with it. You're not part of it. You might as well, to the actual activities of the spiritual world, you don't have any connection with it whatsoever. No, they come down to the material world, and then from there you can go up, down, whatever. Well, everyone in the material world is offensive to Krishna. That's why we're here. Hare Krishna. It's all for now.